The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that brings you the 2021 Absa Africa Financial Markets Index. That's African Asset. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show. We're going to talk to the Airports Company Chief Executive in just a moment. Not surprising to see big losses coming through there, but what of the future? Also tonight, the job losses looming in the steel sector. We'll pick up on that. And a really interesting story. Probably 10 years ago now, Gidon Novick, then at Kalula.com, maybe just slightly before then, proposed this idea that we should have daylight savings time between the east and the west coast of South Africa. So Gauteng would fit in one time zone, probably Central European time, and then Cape Town would appear in GMT plus one or something along those lines, or in Greenwich Mean Time. And there would be this hour time difference, and it would then compensate for the dark mornings in the Western Cape in winter. It would also stagger the peak times for electricity consumption. And I loved that idea. I really did. I thought it was brilliant. People shot me down in flames. It was like my idea. Blame Gidon Novick. And now the FlySafe Air guys are saying, huh, I think this is also a good idea, by the way, that we move public holidays. No matter what day they fall on, you acknowledge that day as the day, whether it be the Day of Reconciliation, Heritage Day, whatever it might be, but the public holiday will always fall on a Friday or a Monday. That's the proposal they want to put to government. It's done in places like the United Kingdom from an efficiency point of view. And what FlySafe Air says is that it will help boost tourism, which needs boosting. What a good idea. Take about 400 years to get through government, but it's still a good idea. We'll hear the proposal on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
I see UKZN, the University of KwaZulu-Natal, has appointed Ruel Khoza as their new chancellor. That's a good move. Well done to Ruel Khoza and lucky UKZN. Well, with few flights and even fewer passengers and a collapse in landing fees, parking revenue and money from concessions at the airports, it's hardly surprising that the airports company, which operates the country's biggest airports, is losing money. A loss of 2.6 billion rand, a second loss in its 28-year history. State-owned monopoly ordinarily would have a license to print money, and for many, many years has done precisely that. And certainly in the decade after the Soccer World Cup, where it had spent far too much on airports, too fast on upgrades, it then got into all kinds of trouble and had to get regulators to up the landing fees and stuff. And it became one of the more expensive airports at which to land and take off from. Now, with no aircraft at all, it's feeling the pinch. Mpumi Mphofu is the chief executive at Airports Company South Africa. She joins us on the line from Johannesburg this evening. Mpumi, when was there a point when there were zero aircraft landing and taking off? Absolutely none. Or did it never get to that sort of day zero?
Good afternoon, Bruce, and good afternoon to your viewers as well. Look, there was a point at which passenger aircraft were limited to repatriations. I'm not sure if you remember. During the total lockdown, we had citizens of countries being repatriated back to their countries. And then we had very muted traffic, but we remained with the repatriations, which ran a long period. And we also had cargo air flights that basically continued to operate. And particularly as we started with the health and pharmaceutical transportation through via air freight of goods from other countries into ours, you started seeing some activity. So we've never really reached a zero, no aircraft landing at all, even during that harshest lockdown in late March into April in 2020.
But what was the quietest month? Was it sort of a 10% of normal? Was it below 10% of normal? Paint a picture for me.
The quietest month would have been about 5%, Bruce.
It's
one aircraft a day that would be repatriating citizens to countries, and then you'd probably have one other aircraft carrying cargo or basically transporting goods. We've seen an increase in the cargo side, and since then, in effect, cargo has performed much better than the passenger airlines, in effect.
What sort of capacity are you operating at now relative to what you were before the lockdowns happened?
I must indicate, Bruce, that there's a big difference between our domestic and international passenger traffic. On the domestic side, I think we've seen significant recoveries. In certain instances, we reach about 40% of our 2019 performance. But on the international side, it's relatively muted at very low levels. And that's globally. That picture is global. You must know that the impact we've had, particularly with the red listing in other countries in Europe and in the United Kingdom, that has had also quite a devastating impact. We're starting to see that open up, and importantly, we are starting to see airlines reporting that they are flying back to South Africa, that they are increasing their frequencies into South Africa. So all of that is good news. But let me say, just on the international side, it's really going to be relatively slow.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I mean, it's a long-haul destination. The world is very attractive and trying to make itself very attractive to tourists. And it's going to take a while to get back to the boom times. It really, really is. But I mean, yeah, so we look at your overall passenger numbers. I mean, they fell by 78% from 21 down to fewer than 5 million. Air traffic movements declined by 60% from nearly 250,000 to fewer than 100,000. So, I mean, it's a very, very significant decline. But being off the red lists will help, no doubt. What you do have in your favour is that your borrowings are quite low. Since 2010, various management teams at the airports company in South Africa have succeeded in paying down debt. And so does this mean that you might be at some point in the not too distant future ready to start embarking on upgrades on some of our airports? For example, the arrivals in the domestic area of Cape Town International is not the most brilliant of designs. One of your predecessors assured me that that was going to be changing soon, and then lockdown happened. I'm wondering if that sort of expenditure is going to happen in the not too distant future.
Bruce, when we had to respond to COVID, we took drastic measures to defer all of our major capital expenditure program, including deferring capacity related and traffic related capital expansion. And that includes the areas such as the terminal buildings in Cape Town, the runway extension, and others. I think the pragmatism of recovery requires of us to be driven by traffic growth. So we're going to be very careful around how we start planning for the reestablishment of those capital programs driven by increases in traffic.
Okay, so no, we don't want to put the cart before the horse on that one. Talk to me about the travelators. My colleague John Perlman on 702 sent me a WhatsApp a little earlier saying, what's happened to the travelators at the airports? 4th of October at night in international, travelators weren't working. And then Sunday night, just in domestic, and I'm sure this was at arriving at O.R. Tambo because he was in Cape Town for the weekend. He says that the travelators are not working. And I've noticed this at various points. I've only flown about 3 or 4 times during this lockdown, various lockdowns, but I have noticed the travelators off. Is that because spare parts are hard to get, or is it just not worth putting them on for the few passengers that are there?
I would indicate one of the issues that we referred to, which was a very drastic measure we took, was the reduction of our operational costs. And in a sense, we had to reduce operational costs by 1.2 billion with an additional amount by cutting through the staff costs an additional 300 million. Now, in essence, what that involved on the operational side is a mothballing of non-operational areas in our terminal buildings. So to cut costs, we had to shut down areas that were not working. And again, you're absolutely correct. We will be reopening those areas, and they will be demand-driven by traffic in those areas. So in certain instances, now we've got, for instance, the D-red listing, and we're busy preparing ourselves. You find in particular areas, maybe there's maintenance work going on in order to prepare for the surge of international traffic that we're going to experience. So there's quite a lot of work of preparation, which might impact around the operational hours of certain systems like the travelators. But it's really in order to prepare us for the increased traffic that we're expecting. And we will be ready at that point. But you're absolutely correct. cost of reopening a travel later and operating it in that day is much more than we are able to derive from the revenues of those passengers. So it becomes very difficult for us. We're still trying to really recover, and sometimes we'll take pragmatic decisions such as those not to expand costs where we are not able to.
And to be blunt, I mean, the travel aids are very nice if it's 11 o'clock at night and you're very, very tired. You can just stand and be carried along. But the purpose of the travel aid is in peak times and busy times to get people moving quickly so that you don't get congestion in arrival and departures halls. It's to get people moving fast between gates. It's not there as a luxury. Its job is to do work. And if there isn't the high passenger volume, well, then it's not as necessary, I would think.
No, absolutely. And particularly in the terminal buildings where the international traffic is still very muted, we're unlikely to have the congestion at all in this period. In fact, as you've seen, our terminal buildings are relatively empty, but in a sense, they're picking up on the domestic side where we are also responding in getting our systems up and running in those areas. But it's given us a good opportunity to also refurbish and maintain our system so that when we get back to normal, we are operating at supreme efficiency.
Mpumi Mpofu, thank you. Chief Executive Officer at the Airports Company, South Africa.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
I see that steel and engineering workers who are on strike have probably lost about 100 million rand in wages in the first week of that strike. And the Engineering and Founders Association's executive, Gordon Angus, is with us. And I'll let him speak for himself in just a moment. But there is a concern that already tens of thousands of jobs have been lost over the past decade and a half in the steel and engineering sectors. And this strike could simply exacerbate that problem. Let's talk to Gordon Angus this evening, Executive Director at the South African Engineers and Founders Association. Give me a picture as to what your biggest concerns are when it comes to the labor force at the moment. Gordon Angus, good evening.
Hi, good evening, David, and thanks for having us. Our concern lies around the escalating wage rates in the metal and engineering industry predominantly. We took a view that over the years, the minimum wage rates in the industry have escalated to a level which is costing the industry jobs, and something drastic needs to happen in terms of addressing that. You mentioned quite correctly that that there's been a loss of jobs. We've had a situation developing where in 2006 there were 287,000 jobs in the industry. In 2020, we've got 258,000 jobs. That's a net loss of 29,000 jobs. And in light of a growing population, an economically active population, that's a serious, serious issue that needs to be addressed urgently.
But at the same time, a living wage is a living wage. Are unions being that unreasonable when it comes to the demands that are being made, the requests that are being made for better wages?
So obviously, one understands that an employee earning a certain wage at the present moment, at a point in time, would be very hard-pressed to take a wage cut. And that's not what we're proposing at all. It's for that reason that we proposed a revision of the new entrant wages into the industry so that employees who are currently employed can continue to enjoy their wage rates and the increases that are passed on by employers every year. But when they leave through natural attrition, be replaced by employees at a more affordable wage rate for the industry that would allow will be conducive to business growth and competitiveness.
Yeah, I see you quoted as saying wages are prohibitively high. Is it the wages that are prohibitively high individually, or is it the wage bill that is prohibitively high in a struggling industry?
So I think it's a bit of both. The wage bills that are faced by metal and engineering companies are high. The bottom line is that employees at a unskilled or let's call it entry level simply cost too much. And the net effect of that over time has been that those jobs are disappearing at an alarming rate. Companies are no longer willing to employ employees at unskilled levels. They're automating and they're downsizing and retrenching and so on. And that's an issue that urgently needs to be addressed. And that's why we've said employees who are currently earning a particular wage rate continue to earn that rate, but we need to address this over time. And the way that we've suggested that is best done is by implementing a new revised new entrant wage rate that is more affordable to employers.
And the unions will naturally say, hold on a second, but you know, we can't eat. We can't eat time. We need money now. The real cost of living is going up and going up far more quickly than the average CPI rate, and wages are linked to CPI. Fuel costs, 19 rand a litre next month, 20 rand a litre possibly by the end of this year, will have huge knock-on impacts. Pressure is building in households, and that pressure then is reflecting in your industry.
Absolutely, which is why we've said that employees who are earning a particular wage rate will continue to earn that wage rate. Nobody's expecting them to take a wage cut at all. That would be grossly unfair and contrary to labour law. So what is being contemplated is that employers be allowed to adjust their overall cost of employment down over time by replacing existing employees who leave through natural attrition. Retirement, resignation, etc.
Trade unions will then say that you'll simply force the old guys who are expensive out and hire cheap younger labour. That is the lack of trust that exists between the workforce and management.
Absolutely. And indeed, they have said that in talks that we've had with them. And what we've put on the table and has been accepted by some of the trade unions in the industry is that we're quite happy to work on a commitment that doesn't happen. So in other words, that no company may deliberately dismiss employees in favor of taking on new employees at the new wage rate. It is something that has to happen over time if we're going to achieve the goals that have been set out in the National Development Plan.
But you don't seem much closer to a resolution. I mean, strike action doesn't benefit employers. It certainly doesn't benefit workers. And we seem to be at an impasse. Is there progress being made in talks?
Yeah, there's always progress being made. Parties are always talking to each other. A lot of those discussions, you'll appreciate at this point in time, are rather informal and things like that. But yes, we are quite far apart. Unfortunately, this is a fundamental issue. It's got to the point where a lot of the industry employers are saying we simply cannot afford what is being put forward by the trade unions, and the trade unions similarly have an entrenched position that they are holding to. We will continue to work day and night to unlock this impasse, but that's where we find ourselves at present.
Gordon Angus, thank you. Executive Director at the South African Engineers and Founders Association, speaking on behalf of the industry, of course, employing workers who are currently on strike, and it doesn't look like we'll go back to work anytime soon.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Flat day on the JSE, but a big turnaround in the fortunes of the currency today. Wade McCurry, and this is all geopolitics. It's all to do with the strength of the dollar and whether or not inflation is here to stay or just visiting. how is the world playing out from your perspective?
Look, Bruce, there is truly at the moment only one answered question, and you've already said it. Is inflation just visiting in the US, or is it going to stay a little bit past longer than expected, a little bit longer than you would want it to stay, like an unwelcome guest?
And what's your sense of it? It feels like the guest has taken off their shoes and is showing no signs of leaving until they've emptied the bar.
Look, Bruce, I still think it's transitory, but it's dependent almost entirely on two things. If oil goes to 95, it's not transitory, but if oil falls to 65, then it is. And there's no sign of it yet that if truly wage costs per unit or labor costs go up, that shows that's underlying inflation. You know, all the others are bottlenecks and used car prices and logistics, which will iron itself out easily within the next year. So those are the two unanswered questions, because if inflation stays 4% plus, the stock market, unfortunately, is only going one way, and that's not up.
Yeah. Got you. And that's the concern that's playing out on global markets at the moment. There was a very big and interesting trading update today, a production update that came out from BHP Group. And, of course, they've had the huge benefits of enormous commodity prices for most of the last year.
Yeah. And, I mean, the productions, I mean, they have a lot of maintenance going on. But more importantly, the outlook for the year was unchanged, I think, in every single item, in every single commodity that they produce. So the market, it was, I suppose, as expected, but only oil was up in the quarter that they reported on, or in the reporting period. Everything else was down, but as I said, that was because of maintenance. So it was as expected, I would say.
I didn't see any news around where Sizwe Platinum today. Your eagle eyes may have been sharper than mine, but something lit a fire under where Sizwe, which went up 76 cents on the day to R1.97. That's an increase of nearly 63%. And it was a huge spike that happened late afternoon, 3 o'clock in the afternoon or thereabouts, half past three. Suddenly there were lots of buying activity in where Sizwe.
Bruce, unfortunately, I'm in the dark, the same as you, so I didn't pick up any news on where Sizwe. So, unfortunately, we both haven't got eagle eyes yet today. But I did notice the share price go up and down. Look, it's not a big company.
No.
But yes, a big move like that is unusual. You know, someone clearly...
It's deeply suspicious is what it is. You're being polite. It's deeply suspicious. And it suggests that there may be some sort of corporate activity that somebody got wind of, because this is a share price that has rocketed to its best levels in more than 10 years.
Oh, very much so. But look, understand, if someone's got wind of corporate activity and it's not public knowledge yet, it will be investigated, I can assure you.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, it's a 2 billion market cap share, so it's not massive, but anything going up... that extent is huge. In fact, the only news I've got here now is the completion of a competent persons report, and you know, I don't think that's going to push it like that. But yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable to go up, you know, 60-odd% in a day.
Yeah, it is, and it looks like there's quite a bit of trading happening in the share today. Nice to see City Lodge coming up quite nicely. It's up at R6.20, recovering from the sort of R2 to R3 level. So investors there, loyal investors, have been rewarded. And then CMH, Combined Motor Holdings, look like they've turned an enormous corner and then done a handbrake turn, and they've had a fabulous time.
Yeah. The report that came out recently was, in fact, very, very good. And I'm a great admirer of the company. It's an extremely well-run company. You know, the management are obviously seasoned campaigners, and they understand the business, and they've pulled through with now, at the moment, firing on all cylinders, quite frankly.
Yeah, firing on all cylinders. Nice one. Wayne McCurry, you're allowed to make car jokes. You understand them. And yeah, the currency also just has staged a nice turnaround too. Yesterday's forecast from the AA, which scared the living daylights out of everybody, nearly R1 a litre fuel price increase next month, and R1.41 on diesel and paraffin. And today, at least, the oil price softened a little and the currency strengthened a little, not enough to make a monumental difference to what's going to be a bit of a fuel price shock next month.
Look, Bruce, I'm a bit worried about the currency strength now. There's no rational reason for the currency to be strengthening, other than oil, which of course we import. We don't export it. Commodity cycle has turned down. Eh? I mean, I think we're at the bottom. I don't think there's much more to go. But platinum in particular is significantly lower than what it was a couple of months ago. And the rand should, in theory, follow that. And it did. You know, it went from 13.20-odd to 15.30-odd, but now it seems to be strengthening. So I think that we're going to see a weaker rand towards the end of this year, maybe 15, maybe 15.50 by the end of the year. But luckily enough, I don't think the oil price is going up. I think it's coming down, and it might actually come down quite significantly, because there is no shortage of oil. There might be problems with capacity, et cetera, but there is absolutely no oil shortage. And I don't think the producers over time want a high oil price, surprisingly enough, because it'll just hasten their demise, and it'll just encourage people more and more to go and buy the electric car. So, you know, the higher the price is now, the shorter time they're going to have in the sun.
Because Wayne McCurry. Wayne, cut you off. How rude. Well, from Wealth and Investments at First National Bank, Wayne McCurry on a Tuesday.
The Money Show is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that brings you the 2021 Absa Africa Financial Markets Index. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. It is nearly 20 minutes to 7 o'clock. And in a moment, the chief executive at Fly Safair, Elmar Kondradi, talked to him about a proposal that he's got, which resonates very strongly with me. Another one that resonates strongly with me comes from Stadio today. Chris Forster, chief executive of Stadio, on a plan to give shares to graduates of Stadio courses. That's a fabulous initiative. And then later on, half past seven this evening, Peter Hundersmark, who is the fund manager at Flagship Asset Management. He has been investing globally for the last 15 years. He's been traveling and investing extensively in emerging markets, and he runs global portfolios at Flagship Asset Management. And I'm going to talk to him this evening about the five things you need to watch out for when investing in emerging markets. Get a view from him also on South Africa relative to other emerging markets. I think that will be useful. On the next Money Show, Pick and Pay's financial results with the brand new chief executive, Peter Boone. Then Paul Hanratty, the group chief executive at Sanlam, will be our shapeshifter. He's been around the block in terms of insurance, and Sanlam is growing hand over fist. Plus, of course, our consumer ninja, Wendy Nola, and Colin Cullis with Business Unusual. A packed Wednesday edition of The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
I find midweek public holidays absolutely infuriating. It very often works quite nicely for people who, if a public holiday falls on a Tuesday or a Thursday, they'll take the Monday or the Friday off and turn it into a long weekend. But for the most of us, it is just a really inconvenient disruption to the rhythm of the week, and it does cause all kinds of other problems. Elmar Conradi is fed up with this as well. He's chief executive of Fly Safair. It's a proposal to propose, if you like. You haven't proposed it yet, Elmar, not publicly or directly to government yet. I think you are feeling out public response that midweek public holidays should just be put on a Monday or a Friday, called what they called now, and let's commemorate whatever it is that we're commemorating on that public holiday, but do it on a Friday or a Monday.
Hi, Bruce. Yeah, that's right. And you're right. So we haven't put the proposal forward just yet. Part of the process is that we need to get the support from the various industries and also from the public and gauge whether there is actually support for the idea or not. But in short, the idea is that, listen, the tourism industry was really hard hit over the past 18 months. You know, we've been trying to see whether there's ways that government can help the tourism industry and the travel industry financially. But if this is something that we can do that's sort of practical, doesn't really cost government money, and would hopefully give the tourism sector in South Africa a boost.
Now, the problem with this proposal, and I recall living in the UK and being told, oh, Monday is a bank holiday. And you'd say, oh, why? Oh, it's just a bank holiday. I think there'd be some resistance in South Africa to this idea, purely because the significance of public holidays is often tied to our very deep and traumatic history. And people want the day to be commemorated on the day. You know, June the 16th must happen on June the 16th, not June the 18th or the 14th, whatever is more convenient. How do we get around that blockage? Because it will be a blockage should this ever go to a proposal stage.
So I mean, we don't want to diminish the historical importance of any of these dates, or sort of say that there's, you know, make a case that it doesn't matter. We think it do matter. So we're proposing that, you know, you still commemorate the historical date on the date. So if there's any celebrations or anything to that effect, that you still do it on the original date, but that the actual public holiday, like you say, like they do in the UK or Ireland or even in America, that they actually do the public holiday, move that to the Friday or the Monday.
Example is, for example, Heritage Day that we recently celebrated. We almost did it sort of the opposite way around. The public holiday was the Friday, and it was Heritage Day the Friday. But most businesses celebrated it the day before at their offices. So I think it is possible to still celebrate the day without diminishing the value of it.
Yeah, and also becomes a question of efficiency as well. We do have a large number of public holidays. At one stage, I think I read somewhere that we have amongst the highest number of public holidays in the world, and some fall on weekends. We don't get the benefit of having the day off. But for most companies, I mean, if you've got a Tuesday or Wednesday or a Thursday public holiday, you can almost write off the part of the week before or after the day anyway, because just so many people utilize that time to take a long weekend anyway. So why not formalize it? And in so doing, your argument is it'll boost tourism and tourism capacity. How is the airline going, Elmar? I mean, you flew throughout the bits that you could fly. You capitalized on the fact that for a long time, Comair and Kalulu.com weren't flying. SAA wasn't flying. And I think you've expanded quite substantially over the last 18 months.
Yeah, Bruce, I can only describe it as a roller coaster ride. I mean, there were months, if we look back at June and July when we were in level 3 and level 4, lockdown again, the demand and the people that were traveling completely dried up. And then at the moment, there's not enough flights in the market, if you look at it, even between us and the other airlines. So it's really been a sort of a roller coaster ride where the 1 month you sort of worry about your cash flows and what's going to happen, and then the next month you're completely full to capacity and things are going great. So we're actually sort of getting used to this up and down, and we sort of tell ourselves that, we need to probably still prepare that there's going to be a few more downs in the next year or so until we actually get to a point where I think enough of the population is vaccinated that we can prevent these kinds of lockdowns and restrictions.
But have you expanded your route network substantially? Did I see right that you're doing a Mauritius route now that they're opening for visitors?
Yeah, since lockdown last year, we've actually added three routes. We started flying Durban-Lanseria. We also started flying Cape Town Bloemfontein, and then in December this year we'll add our first international flight, and it will be between Joburg and Mauritius, like you say. And as you mentioned, our market share over the past year has grown to about 45%, which isn't purely just our doing. It's also just because the market is smaller and there's less competitors in the market, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, and how are bookings looking around the Christmas period? I mean, there's uncertainties around a fourth wave and all of that sort of stuff. But I think people are desperate to do lots of domestic travel. And now with, the likely increase in foreign travellers coming through, there could be some nice demand on the horizon.
Yeah, so at this stage, the demand for December is actually better than last year this time. And last year this time, we actually expected quite a big December before the second wave hit us.
Yeah.
So at this stage, it's actually looking better than last year in terms of the forward bookings.
Excellent. Thank you to Elmar Conradi, Chief Executive at Fly Safair. Would you support that idea? I'd certainly support it. I really would. I think it's a brilliant idea. I think it would be a lot more efficient. I think you'd get far more benefit from getting a regular long weekend break rather than sort of dragging yourself into the office on Monday and kids going to school on Monday, but they're not on Tuesday, then back on Wednesday. I think I find that midweek disruption incredibly ineffective. Somehow in South Africa particularly, you've got to be able to commemorate that particular public holiday regardless on the day in which it falls. But would you be able to stomach the idea of June the 16th being commemorated on the 14th or the 18th, depending on the day of the week that it fell on? I wonder. Give us a call if you'd like to chat.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Welcome to The Money Show. Chris Forster is with us. He is Chief Executive at Stardew. And you've bought shares in Stardew, which you're going to keep for graduates of Stadio when they complete their courses, Chris Forster. Please explain the thinking.
Yes, good evening, Bruce, and thank you for the opportunity. I'm just from a graduation ceremony now where we announced the Kulisa Student Share Scheme to our graduates. And I must say, the students and their families reacted extremely positive to the news. The scheme, Bruce, is where Stadio will make shares available or give shares to postgraduate students. I must emphasize only to postgraduate students who complete their degrees with Stadio for them to start building up their own portfolio.
How significant? I mean, it's easy to get the PR around this, and then somebody graduates, they get their postgrad degree, they're fully paid up, and then they get a little envelope and says, congratulations, you've got yourself a Stadio share. Well done. That's me being highly cynical about, you know, companies looking for publicity around great schemes. How significant could it be for some of your students?
So, yeah, Bruce, we see this just as the first step. How many shares will students receive? They will receive 1,000 rand worth of Stadio shares in this first allocation. But I think more important for the students is the relationship that we also have on this specific scheme with Investec Wealth Services, where Investec will assist us in training programs, in making students aware of the financial markets and how shares work. A lot of these students would not necessarily ever experience being owners or shareholders in a specific institution or in companies. So I think we see it wider than just these 1,000 rand worth of shares to these students, but it's the start of a whole journey of creating their own wealth and portfolio going forward.
It's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, because I think rather than being given points for banking in a particular way or points for buying a particular shampoo in a pharmacy, I would love companies where I shop to give me shares as a reward. And they could use fractional shares and you could be rewarded by the companies that you supported. And I suppose in this way, this idea of Stadio holding shares for postgraduate students being awarded is a little bit like that. It's saying, thank you for coming to us. Thank you for entrusting us with your education. Here is a reward which you can cash in immediately, or you can begin an incredibly exciting learning journey beyond university and really look at wealth creation.
That's exactly how we see it, Bruce. And, you know, we stand for widening access, as you know, and this is another attempt from Stadio to widen more than just educational offerings for our students, but then also making them aware of these financial markets. And then very important for us, we believe as a private institution, we will also gain a very active and participative alumni that would really give us quality feedback on their qualifications as they are now also vested in the institution.
How many postgraduate students sort of do graduate every year? Is it a 1,000? Is it more than that?
Yes, it's about approximately 1,200 students that will qualify annually, Bruce, for these awards.
Okay, so I mean, it does come at a cost. I mean, you've got to buy the shares to distribute to the students. I mean, this isn't a freebie by any stretch of the imagination. Does it feel like a little bit of a rewards program that, you know, you've spent money with us, your parents spent money with us, and, you know, instead of giving you e-bucks or something, let's give you something that can grow in value?
Yeah, we would like to give something back to those students that supported us. And then also to make sure, you know, that we get them started and on their way. Maybe something important to note is that these are not new shares, so there's no dilution of the current shareholders. These are shares that Stadio will buy up in the market and then distribute to these postgraduate students who qualify.
It's a very exciting scheme. Chris Forster, thank you. Chief Executive at Stadio. More companies should do it. I really do think so. And I think from that reward scheme perspective, wouldn't you love it if the companies you shopped at, if you went to Spur often, that you got, you know, whatever points that they give you, and instead of giving you cash back or whatever it is that they do at the tills at Dis-Chem or Clicks, or at if you with FNB on eBucks or whatever the other banking system banking rewards are, that you gradually built up tiny minuscule portions of shares in your name that you could then utilize to build a portfolio. And that way you would be truly investing in yourself by shopping.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702. Let's walk the talk.
That I'm sure is incredibly complicated.
I haven't read news bulletins in many, many years.
But a lovely idea.
In my past life, I read millions of news bulletins,
was a news editor in my day. And I understand just how difficult it is to every half hour deliver news flawlessly. And Sifiso Zulu does it 99.5%. But he made the most glorious Freudian slip in Eyewitness News. I must go back and listen to it now. Maybe it was just my wishful thinking. But did he just refer to it as Brent screwed oil? I think he did. And if he didn't, he should have. Yeah, because at $85.41 a barrel, $61 a barrel, Brent screwed oil, that's absolutely, I think it's an absolutely perfect description of Brent screwed. Because you are going to get screwed on the fuel price. There's going to be very little change coming out of a rand extra on every litre of petrol that you're going to buy from the first Wednesday of next month, and very little out of 1 rand 41. No change out of that on diesel and paraffin. Brent screwed. I think we should call it that as a matter of course. Well done, Sifiso Zulu. The Money Show, proudly brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that brings you the 2021 APSA Africa Financial Markets Index. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Ad feature.
With Andy Rice.
Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros. Are we seeing enough people, Andy? And this has been your bugbear since the earliest days of COVID-19, and you were worried that people weren't getting clear messages through on behavior. And since we've had vaccines and vaccinations, you've been very concerned that we're not sending out smart vaccination messages. You've got a couple of examples, or at least one example, of one that may or may not be working.
Well, there's the big news in this topic over the last couple of weeks has been the launch of the Solidarity Fund's campaign, their contribution to the fight to get levels of vaccination up. Very big budget, multimedia program under the concept or the insight of people wanting to get back to living. That's the line that's used. And that's to be the motivation for people to take action and stop being hesitant. It's a campaign that, according to Wendy Clue, who is the head of marketing at the Solidarity Fund, is data-driven. And that's encouraging because, not that I'm a great fan of data, but I'm a great fan of measurement. And this is a kind of campaign that you really can see the results. We're asking for a particular action to happen, and let's see if they follow suit. It's too early to say how successful it will be, but the flagship piece of advertising is a longish, I would say about, it might be 90 seconds, it might even be 2 minutes, a television commercial or a broadcast commercial. And it has a kind of gritty, moody, quite languid, almost black and white, I think, from the impression it left on me, story about, you know, about ordinary South Africans. And in that regard, it reminds me a little bit of some of the financial services campaigns, the Alan Grays of this world, or even Nedbank. So I think it's in that genre, and let's see what it does. But let's be grateful and pleased that the Solidarity Fund has got things rolling from a communications point of view. The one thing I do want to see is how it will be meshed with any brands that heed the call to come forward with their own campaigns. And that's going to be quite important to see how Roll Up Your Sleeves South Africa, which is the sort of clarion call of the campaign, how that can be adapted by other brands. I think that the permission is granted very clearly for other brands to use that same creative concept of rolling up your sleeves, but in support of their own brand simultaneously. So let's see how that goes. That's what I'd love to see happen.
I really hope it works, because the message needs to get through and people need to hear it often and clearly. John Lewis, though, has walked into a bit of a controversy. Now, I know you love John Lewis, particularly towards this time of year, usually because of beautiful Christmas advertising, and it tugs the heartstrings and people wait for the John Lewis Christmas ad in the UK the way I wait for Norman Goodfellow's Christmas booze catalogue. Not that I, you know, buy anything out of it. It's just vicarious living. That's what it is. But John Lewis, what have they done wrong?
Well, as you rightly say, as we get towards December, the UK media are really trying to second guess what the new John Lewis Christmas ad might be like. And when they announced there was a new advertisement coming out a week or so ago, and there was a bit of comment about this is surely too early for Christmas, and indeed it is. It's not a John Lewis Christmas campaign, so there's no hills of snow and tobogganing animals and trampolining dogs and all the other things that they've had in the past. This is for a particular division of John Lewis, their home insurance product and range of products, I imagine. And they've made a television commercial through an agency called Adam and Eve, one of the biggest agencies in the UK. And it features, it's hard to describe, so I may sort of give up halfway through, but it basically follows a child of a boy of about 10, thereabouts, dancing dramatically through his home and managing to cause a lot of damage, unwittingly, we assume, along the way by colliding with things and kicking off his shoes and then knocking jars onto the floor and all sorts of things. He leaves a trail of havoc while dancing to the Stevie Nicks song, Edge of 17. And it's beautifully shot, but the main thing that makes it stand out is that the boy in question is wearing his mother's clothes, or we assume his mother's. He's wearing a dress, high heels, makeup liberally and slapdashily applied. It closes with the line, let life happen. That's right. So it's really a message of tolerance, a message of don't worry, we'll pick up the pieces metaphorically and literally. But it's caused huge uproar in the UK, hundreds of complaints, others rallying quickly to the cause, saying it's great to see such a clear LGBTQ messaging and confidence, and most of the critics are being tarred with the homophobic and bigoted brush. But of course, the one other question is, will they actually pay out for that kind of wanton damage that the boy seems to be demonstrating? But it's worth looking up. It's an intriguing piece of communication. And best of all, it's done what advertising always has to do, which is to take a stance and be distinctive. And there's no denying that's what the John Lewis home insurance campaign does.
Okay, interesting. Your hero this week, please.
Well, there was a gala dinner last week to celebrate the winners of the first round of South African Effie Awards, EFFIE. That is the Effectiveness Awards. It takes the place of the old, and in my case, much loved Apex Awards that used to measure the same thing, but with different methodologies. And the Effies is a global brand. There are Effie Awards competitions in most major advertising countries. So there are global norms that people can use. And it's fully understandable why the Effies has really taken the place of the Apex Awards, because it's less onerous to enter. It's a little cheaper to enter. More brands enter for that reason. I'm sure it'll become one of the, like the Lurys, I'm sure it'll become one of the sort of benchmark award systems in the country. And the winner, in fact, awarded a global grand prize, that's what they call it. There's the usual bronze, silver, and gold. And then above the gold, there is the grand prize. And that this year goes to Checkers for a campaign to launch their new rewards card, which I think is called Extra Savings or thereabouts. And there's a very nice television spot which uses Dynamo, the magician. I love magic, and he just shows how all the cards that you've got in your wallet can be reduced to just the one, because that's all you really need is the Checkers extra savings card. I haven't seen any metrics, any statistics to justify the claims of being effective, but it's clearly very visible and very successful according to a panel of esteemed judges. And so well done to Checkers. I think they've really raised the game in terms of marketing and advertising in recent years, reflecting also their ambition to raise the game in terms of where they stand in the retail market, which is sort of now taking on Woolies more than taking on ShopRite. Pick and Pay at the lower end. So let's congratulate Checkers, their agency 99 Cents, and not forgetting the many other winners. The other ones in the medal classes were Time Bank and First for Women. They both won gold awards, but the grand prize, as I say, went to Checkers, so they are this week's hero.
Fantastic. And your zero, please. We can't let you go without a zero.
No, I won't go without a zero. What I've selected this week is one that really jumped out at me quite unpleasantly from the television screen. And it's yet another in the multiplying category of short-term insurance, with all of the many different packages and bonuses and kickbacks and whatever that the category seems to be littered with. In this case, my problem is from Dial Direct that they have chosen as their creative platform a conversation about insuring your car between a child of about 8 and what is it, presumably his or her father. And the child uses adult language. I don't mean adult in a rude way. I just mean mature language, shall we say. Words like participation don't seem to really trip off the tongue from an 8-year-old boy as authentically as perhaps they should. And it's always a difficult thing to use kids in advertising, because if you just do it casually, it won't work. It won't come out well at all. It's a really difficult genre. It requires a director who's very good at performance. And for me, this particular Dial Direct ad of the father and the son discussing the benefits of Dial Direct's vehicle insurance just smacks of opportunism and really corner cutting. It's weak and slightly squirmy.
Weak and slightly squirmy. That is the most damning critique I've heard of an advert for a long time, Andy Rice. Thank you. Andy Rice with our heroes and zeros. Weak and slightly squirmy. That is the Dial Direct father-son sales pitch masquerading as a charming parenting moment. And then the Checkers grand prize at the Effie Awards, the Effectiveness Awards, gets the big fat hero status. Lots of talking points around the vaccine rollouts and the messaging around vaccines, which is coming through thicker and faster than before, which is also awesome to see.
The Money Show is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that brings you the 2021 Absa Africa Financial Markets Index. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Well, you can call him a shapeshifter, but that'll be tomorrow, George. Tonight, of course, it is our investment school. That's what we do on a Tuesday. Good. Everyone on the same page? Excellent. Peter Hundersmark is a fund manager at Flagship Asset Management. He thought I was going to get all personal with him. He must have broken into a small sweat. But are you used to small sweats, I'm sure, Peter? You've been traveling around the world, I don't know, for the last 15 years, investing in emerging markets as an investment class. Have you been a glutton for punishment, or has it been quite a fulfilling 15 years?
Hi, Bruce. It's been rewarding, but there have been some hard lessons learned, and I think that's really what I'd like to share a little bit today, the things that you should watch out for.
Okay, so I'm very, very keen to learn your lessons. When we talk about emerging markets as a class, just give me a sense of what that is nowadays.
So we're talking about countries such as Mexico, Colombia, Argentina. We're talking about Turkey, Russia, India, and China, and then all the host of small Asian countries.
And I'm sorry, I need to interrupt there because, you know, whenever anybody puts China into emerging markets, I go, but it's an emerged market. It is the world's second biggest economy. And we still refer to it as an emerging market. And, you know, Russia, for all of its foibles and weirdness, is also, once the epicenter of a global superpower. Why do we class these countries as emerging markets? What is the reason for it?
So that's a good question. There's a variety of human development indicators that you look at in terms of GDP per capita, poverty levels, and things like that, that separate developed countries from emerging markets. And I guess the lesson there a little bit is although these countries have emerged a little bit, as you mentioned, there are still streaks behind developed countries, which obviously haven't stood still while China was emerging. And another thing that you do talk about when you talk about emerging markets is the strength of their institutions. So, you know, you talk about, China being emerged, but 20 years ago, you know, this country was closed to the world, far more closed than it is today. In GDP per capita was less than South Africa's and all. You know, so there's still a fragility and an embryonic state there that is, still emerging.
I love the way you just said, well, 20 years ago, China's GDP was less than South Africa's. And we forget that. And we forget that through deliberate action and deliberate process and deliberate decision making and action, you can turn around the fortunes of a country. and China is the prime example of that.
It really is. And it's quite impressive. And that's understating of what they've been able to achieve there. But I think your words there are correct. You know, you really need intention. You really need to put the right people and the right policies in place. These things don't happen by accident.
No, they most certainly don't. So what have you learned over the last 15 years of traveling around the world? I mean, break it into maybe macroeconomics actually does matter, doesn't it? I mean, you can be a brilliant business, but in a dysfunctional environment, and actually nobody's going to want to invest in you.
Absolutely. I think one of the key considerations, you know, most of your listeners will have investments in global funds, and those global funds are taking positions in emerging markets, either through direct investments in those countries, or they have positions that they've bought in other countries that have revenues coming from emerging markets. So I guess, the statement there, most of these emerging markets that I mentioned are geopolitically and macroeconomically fragile relative to developed markets. So if you look at what these countries can do with their, the two major tools you have, which is, your fiscal policy and your monetary policy, they are far more constrained in terms of what they can achieve and how they can combat, headwinds that occur, either, commodity prices or interest rates or inflation. They're just far more constrained in what they can achieve. So that's the first big lesson, is that macroeconomically, if you're trying to invest in a country like, for example, Turkey or Brazil, you really need to understand, for example, that Turkey imports a whole bunch of its oil. It's very dependent on its export sector. You need to have a really good macroeconomic view of that country. And similarly, Brazil, you need to understand the role that, soft and hard commodities play in its export balance. You need to understand the psychological impact that inflation has had there, and the policies that they put in place to combat that. You know, there's a lot going on in these countries. You need to really take a hard look at.
How would you categorize South Africa in that mix? Because of course we are one of them.
Yeah, it really is, and South African investors, I think, are quite adept at understanding what happens in emerging markets, because, macroeconomically, we understand that our interest rates, if we raise them, then our currency becomes a bit more attractive. We understand that the funding of our government comes from issuing bonds, and there's a price attached to that in terms of how we conduct ourselves as a country macroprudentially. So there's a lot of learnings that South Africans in terms of understanding inflation can carry across to other emerging markets. So I actually think there's quite a number of good South African investors that have done quite well investing in emerging markets.
Is there a culture of investing in emerging markets? And if you are in South Africa and you are subject to Regulation 28, I wonder whether you should be investing in other emerging markets. And perhaps you should be, because China is growing and that's great. But just how much more exposure you should have to emerging markets when you're in one. And you know, we see so much boom and bust mentality when it comes to the approach to emerging markets. Is that a cultural thing?
It's absolutely true. But you must remember, you know, you're not going to escape emerging markets. Whether you think you're investing in developed markets, you know, many will think, you know, Anheuser-Busch or Heineken or BAT or whatever, you know, these big conglomerates are getting a large chunk of their revenue from emerging markets. They're getting a large chunk of their earnings. And most importantly, for a lot of them, it's a large chunk of their growth. So the investment case for many of the stocks that are in you know, most of your listeners' global funds does hinge on emerging markets. So you need to learn to price those revenue streams. You need to learn to price the risk, you know, and the return that is coming out of countries like Brazil, like Turkey, like Russia, like China. And you know, I've lumped them all together as emerging markets, but they are very distinct, and each one has separate risks. Now, we've obviously seen a lot about and heard a lot about China recently, and I'll touch on that a little bit later when we talk about regulation. But the you know, the risks there, you know, have really come to the fore in terms of how they're conducting themselves as a nation. And you know, I spoke a bit earlier about Turkey needing to understand the balance of how they import and what's impacting their economy, and Russia is the same.
Culturally, sorry, as well. I mean, Turkey, for goodness sake. I mean, the president keeps firing members of the central bank, and he wonders why his bond market and currency markets are in such turmoil. There is just no sort of semblance of independence.
Yeah, I think culturally, what's important for me to understand when I'm investing is, you know, we sit in South Africa, and we, you know, your dad made money out of shares. Your grandfather probably had shares. There's a real culture of equity ownership, and it sits, you know, it's embedded in how we believe wealth should be created. And that's quite a Western way of thinking. And it manifests in our pension funds and in our savings. So we all hold stocks, and you know, I'm here talking on you know, a money show where we're talking about, equities and investing. But, you know, there's a decidedly different take on that in many emerging markets. So there's not such an entrenched culture of equities. The listed space in India or in Turkey or in Mexico or in Russia is not nearly what it is in developed markets. You know, there's no culture of, you know, equities is the way I'm going to preserve or grow wealth. So, you know, if you use Turkey as an example, it's been, you know, it's been a frightfully dull market in terms of listings or mergers or acquisitions. It's really not an equity-friendly culture. Most of the businesses listed there are holding companies, and that's just because the owners decided to liquidate or exit their structures. But you're right. You know, you need to invest in countries where there's a cultural support for equities, and that manifests in their savings and pension industry.
And that regulatory environment that you referred to a moment ago, and we've seen a huge change, and maybe it wasn't a change, maybe it was just a tightening up. I'm not too sure how you interpret it. But from our perspective, we've just seen the destruction of the values of Prosus and LastPass as a result of a change of tone in China when it comes to digital companies. And of course, Prosus and LastPass together own 30% of Tencent, which is a massively, probably too successful a Chinese company.
So, you know, Bruce, I think that's a good example. You know, China has been very topical lately because of the change in regulation that they've published. I think the lesson there is quite frankly that emerging markets, and particularly China, they have a different agenda. You know, in the West, you know, we would look at, or at least up until like 5-6 years ago, you would look at capitalism and the pursuit of wealth and growth to be almost sacrosanct, and those are the goals of society, and there's sacrifices that are made to achieve those goals. And in China, it's different. They're willing to make different sacrifices to achieve different goals. So that's really, you know, if you approach it from a view that, you know, things should be like the U.S. or things should be like Europe or even South Africa, you know, you're going to lose money. You need to understand that, you know, that society is trying to achieve different things than what you may think is valuable. So, you know, you look at what they did in the education space. You know, the desire at the moment is to achieve, you know, a population growth. And because of that, you need to have a more affordable education. And so that's something that they see as a market failure. And you know, the Communist Party is going to step in and make it more affordable. You know, that's how they roll. And I think, you know, that's coming to that local knowledge. You need to understand that.
But there is so much to understand, and so much of what we think we understand, we have absolutely no clue about because of just the substantially different approach in so many markets, and particularly when it comes to China. I mean, sitting, you know, 10,000 miles away from Beijing, there is absolutely no way that you can fund them unless you spend an awful lot of time there and really assimilate it. I don't know if you can fully understand the approach the Chinese take to managing that economy.
I think the best approach is to start out very humble and just to say, look, you know. And I think the smartest approach is to say, I don't know, but these are the things that I would like to know. And I think if you approach it from that angle, it's far wiser than coming in and saying, well, this has been my experience, and this is the experience of you know, the developed markets, which, of course, everyone is now gravitating towards. And therefore, you know, surely China and everyone else will come to the same conclusion, and everyone will, you know, become homogenistic and the same. You know, I think if you approach it rather from a perspective that, you know, China is an ancient society that thinks very long term, they have, as I said, different goals in what they want to achieve. And you should approach that with a little bit of humility and say, well, you know, let's understand it. And once I understand it, I'll invest in the areas that I believe, you know, hold, you know, the same societal goals and have the same outcomes that they want to achieve. You know, that's unfortunately how that market works. You know, and it's not alone. Russia is the same. You know, you need to understand that this is a style of government that is not familiar to most Westerners. You know, Brazil, you need to understand that they've only had a central bank really for 20 years. They've only had, you know, anything longer than a 5-year bond since 2007. You know, these institutions and these countries are you know, their children compared to, you know, the Western countries. And I'm not saying that they will grow up to be the same either. They will grow up to be different countries, different identities. And China is a very good example of that.
Yeah, I mean, and we've just, you know, there's a huge amount of arrogance, I think, in the world of investing sometimes, and we kind of think that everybody should, you know, think the way we do and behave the way we do, and we make the assumption that things will continue in a straight line, and they very seldom do, if ever, when it comes to the world of investing.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, the China situation we've seen now is a very good wake-up call for managers that have invested, you know, with the wrong pretense or with the wrong idea. And there's been a sort of consensus, nice, warm and fuzzy consensus that, well, you know, China will slowly open up and everyone will understand the benefits of being part of, you know, the global community and so on and so forth. And everything will remain just fine. And there's nice and solid growth there. But, you know, I think things are far more complicated, and you really need to delve into the descend into the detail to understand what's happening in these countries and what their societies want to achieve. Because ultimately, as an investor, those are things you need to understand. They form, you know, part of the mosaic.
And currencies. I mean, if ever there was a level of paranoia, it's being exposed to developing market currencies, emerging market currencies.
Bruce, I must say this is one of the more difficult areas. And I've actually, you know, if I talk about the five things you must watch out for, currency stands out on its own because it's so important. And it really means that if you're going to move out of the natural hunting grounds, let's say, of most global investors, which is United States, Europe, and Japan, if you're going to move into an emerging market, you really need to understand the vulnerabilities of that currency. You need to understand where you are in that country's cycle, you know, its economic cycle. Is inflation rising? Is it falling? Or interest rates rising, falling? Because these are all things that will impact inflation, interest rates, and hence the currency. And I think South Africans understand that very well. You know, I can give you so many examples, but, you know, there's a business in Mexico, which is a Coke bottler. It's a fantastic business, and it's delivered, you know, in Mexican pesos, a good, you know, 8% return over the last 5 years, which is nothing fantastic, but it's not bad either. But if you look at what that's done in dollars, it's you've lost money in dollars. You know, you can construct entire investment cases on good businesses with great management teams, all the things that people talk about when they come on to a show like this and they say, this is the, you know, the stock I want. And you can still lose money in hard currency. So, you know, you really need to understand that if you're going to move into emerging markets with your investments, as an investment manager, you really need to have a view on where that currency is going, because that's where you can lose and make a lot of money.
So when you then zoom out and you look at this world of developing markets, are there opportunities to be had for us in South Africa as people who may be apprehensive about South Africa's, let's go through it, the macros, the regulatory environment, whether or not there really is that much support for investors in South Africa, the vulnerability of the currency. Diversification is the key word. I wonder what your view is on the way in which South Africans should be thinking about behaving with their money.
I think the South Africans' local opportunity set is quite limited. You know, the JSE has done astoundingly well over the past year. And I think many South Africans have breathed a sigh of relief because, you know, things looked rather dark at this time last year for returns. And they've been rewarded quite well. But those returns really have been coming from quite distinctly, you know, concentrated areas. Platinum, you know, resources stocks, and a few other counters have really led the way, and of course, Naspers hasn't helped at all. So, I guess even on purely a diversification argument, the South Africans should be using their offshore allocation, and the investment funds that South Africans are investing in should be using their offshore allocation purely just to diversify away from, you know, the business models we have available here. There's a wide world out there. South Africans are, you know, generally good investors, are quite savvy, and you can price the risks because you understand, you know, we understand emerging markets, we understand inflation, interest rates, currencies, and I think you can, you know, you can really make some good returns.
What is the lay of the land? The global paranoia at the moment is that the world has been artificially inflated, and the world has been supported not only through the global financial crisis, which didn't have any real impact on inflation. It just poured trillions of dollars over a decade into global markets. COVID came along. There was a short, sharp shock. Central banks stepped in once again and boosted markets. And now we're sitting with massive debt burdens on national balance sheets all over the world. We've got inflation beginning to come into the system, transitory or longer term. What is your reading of the state of the world of investing right now?
So, Bruce, I think we've moved into a world where both fiscally and socially there is absolutely no appetite to allow asset prices to fall. You know, you spoke about all the money that's been pumped into the system, that's been printed to support asset prices. Over the last 8 years, you've seen the Federal Reserve try, you know, carefully to lift interest rates, and you know the taper tantrum and all these different things happened, where there's just such an enormous pushback, and now there's such a fragility in the system where everything is supported by asset prices, and you know interest rates are at rock bottom, so even slight movements there on a percentage basis makes such an enormous impact to the debt loads of corporates and governments and institutions around the world, that, you know, we're in a very, very odd space. You know, obviously, you know, the thing that kills bull markets like the one we've been in for, you know, since 2009 is interest rates. It's a very blunt instrument, but what it does is it changes the price of money, it increases the price, and it puts a brake on the economy. It basically stops lending. And with that, it stops everything. So it's a very blunt tool, and it typically leads to recessions, but it is a way of stopping the excesses. Now to get that appetite from the Federal Reserve, I'm simply not seeing it. Even in the latest comments by Powell, there's still talk of a very dovish, gradual rise. We'll have to see inflation manifest, you know, perfectly and way above range before we start raising interest rates. You know, as you know, his view at the moment is still that it's transitory. So, you know, my view is over the next couple of years, we're going to see financial repression, which is inflation, running a bit hot, and in interest rates not compensating for it. So financial repression, for your listeners, is where you're not compensated via interest rates for the level of inflation.
Does that mean that money then keeps flowing into equities? That money, people keep looking for yield. They keep looking for dividends, and therefore we see more investment into equities rather than bond markets.
Initially, that is exactly the case. But as interest rates start to rise and bonds start to exhibit a more normal pricing, then you'll start seeing more investment into bonds. But that is still some way away. You need to see a proper yield. You need to see the yield on bonds increase above the yield that you can currently receive on high quality equities, and that's not the case. So it's still okay for equities for now, and it's an asset allocator's dream
minefield
to be able to use. Well, it's his dream to be able to use more assets, because at the moment, you know, in multi-asset funds, there's this enormous issue where, you know, cash is not giving you any return. Bonds are uninvestable, at least from my point of view, just because of the artificial pricing in the bond market on interest rates. So everyone is forced into equities. And for a multi-asset investment mandate, you know, you're looking to find assets that correlate differently and generate long-term returns. It's very difficult. So the dream, as I mentioned, is once again to have assets that can, achieve different outcomes in a portfolio. And that's still some ways off.
Really loved the chat. Thank you, Peter Hundersmark, the fund manager at Flagship Asset Management this evening, headmaster of the Investment School.